Some say the most beautiful sight in the world is a fleet of ships, an army, or horsemen. But I say it's what your heart desires. And I felt, you know, it's important for people who are dying, who are being told you have to put your affairs in order. You need to sign the deeds over to somebody of your property. You need to resolve your banking. And I'm thinking to myself, there are the affairs of the heart that need to be put in order as well. So here you have a hierarchy, and the heart's desire comes ahead of whether it is the fleet of ships you own or whatever else. That's important.
Hello and welcome. My name is Liz Gleeson, and you're listening to Shapes of Grief. Shapes of Grief is a curation of stories from international guests who share their unique experience of grief. These stories are shared with the wish that you, the listener, may find some comfort, hope, and solidarity, and maybe also the realization that you're not alone in your grief. Each time you listen, please do support the podcast by donating on the website shapesofgrief.com or by becoming a patron on patreon.com. It's a privilege to hold these conversations, and I extend my deepest gratitude to all my guests for showing up in this particular way. It truly is a gift. Welcome back to the Shapes of Grief podcast. Liz Gleeson here with you. And I'm joined today by Mary Shine Thompson. Mary, you're very, very welcome.
Thank you so much, Liz. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Mary has recently compiled a beautiful book of poetry from all over the world and throughout the ages for the Irish Hospice Foundation, Poems for When You Can't Find the Words. And I think a lot of us will resonate this, anyone who's experienced a bereavement, so much grates on our ears and on our heart in the aftermath of a bereavement until that poem lands on our desk from somebody on a card or in an email, and we go, that's it, they get it, this poet understands. So I'm really looking forward to talking to you, Mary, about the book. And just for our listeners, just to give you a little bit of background on who Mary is. Mary's worked in the field of English literature for decades at this point, specializing in Anglo-Irish literature, particularly 20th century Irish literature. But this poetry collection, you know, contains poets from all over the globe, as I said already. So we'll come back to that. Mary was Dean of Humanities for a while in DCU and also did a stint as governor there. And following, I don't want to say retirement, but maybe it was retirement, you went on and did the bar exams as a retirement project, which is fascinating. And you've done some work in restorative justice with your new credentials. So Mary, first of all, welcome. Welcome from Drumcondra in Dublin.
Thank you, Liz. As I say, it's great to be here. And I'm so pleased to be talking about this project, which I am very dedicated to, I must say. I was really honoured to be asked to do the editing on this work by the Irish Hospice Foundation and Poetry Ireland, who combined in order to get this show on the road. And Liz, I was really delighted when you were giving your introduction. I felt you've got it. You know exactly what this book is about when you said, you know, it's difficult sometimes for people to find the right words for their grief. And it's difficult to find the words when you're ill that have the scope and the depth to cope with the whole range of emotions that are rushing through your mind. And I hope that at least some of these poems will resonate with the people whom we want to talk to.
And that's exactly it. You use those words, scope and depth, you know, and the experience of grief and loss can be utterly profound. It isn't always, but it can be absolutely profound, and it can bring us to internal landscapes where we've never gone before. And we've no map, we've no words, and it seems like we're the only people dwelling in this new existence
Exactly. And indeed, every journey of dying is a journey where you're on your own. And I think that's one of the really important points to be made about the whole thing. In a way, you are alone in this. And if you can find the right kind of person to talk to, then sometimes the right kind of friend, I suppose. And I imagined each poem as the kind of friend who knows when to be silent, when to talk, when to nudge you forward with a suggestion about an emotion or something, and who won't overload you, who knows also when to stop. And that's what I had in mind when I was looking at all those poems, you know.
That would be a fantastic friend to find, but it's so true. It's sometimes not in human form. You know, the pages of a book can offer immense comfort and education to us, actually, at these times. Yeah. I remember a few years ago being at a funeral. A little girl had died. She was 6 years old. And I happened to be beside her mother, you know, at the gates of the church, as people were coming up and offering their condolences. And every single person just said, there are no words. There are no words. There are no words. And initially I was like, okay, you know, sometimes there's no words. But as the 20th, 30th, 40th person said, there are no words, in my head I thought, ah, come on now, there sometimes are words.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And you know, maybe to those of us who are pedestrians and not poets, it's difficult to find the words.
Yes.
But there are words, and we must find them. And I remember following that, I actually produced a little video called There Are Words, with some suggestions. But I think you're going to even bring this a lot further for us. Tell us how the project started.
Well, I wasn't responsible for starting this project. The education officer in Poetry Ireland, Jane O'Hanlon, happened to be having a conversation with somebody from the Irish Hospice Foundation, Rebecca Lloyd. And in conversation, it came up, why couldn't they do something together? The Hospice Foundation and Poetry Ireland, which is the organisation for poetry and poets in Ireland. And that was the germ of the idea. Then a sort of group of us got together enthusiastically about it. And the director of Poetry Ireland back then, Niamh O'Donnell was her name, she was very excited about the idea. And so we managed to get some funding. Poetry Ireland was very generous with the funding. DCU put in some funding, the Hospice Foundation as well. And between us, we got the thing off the ground. And Liz, one interesting thing about it was that it began to take shape during COVID. And COVID, that whole COVID experience, I think was in the background of many of our minds when we were doing this, you know. It informed a lot. We felt we had more empathy with people at the end of life, and perhaps people who were bereaved, because of the uncertainty of the moment we all found ourselves in, you know.
It pulled you all into that landscape of loss.
Exactly.
Immediately, yeah. And it was quite a backdrop to be doing any grief work against living through that pandemic.
Yeah.
Yes, so Mary, your task was to select the poetry for this compilation.
Yes.
How did you do that? Do you have a background in loss yourself? I mean, you know, I assume we all experience loss throughout our lives. How are you au fait with this landscape?
Oh, indeed. I mean, there's nobody that death doesn't touch immediately. And as I say, in the whole COVID landscape, I think that was even more to the point. When I was 26, the brother who was next to me, he was 25, died suddenly of a heart attack. I mean, one day he was fine, the next day he wasn't. And it was such a trauma, as I need hardly say this. And it became a sort of shaping experience for everything that happened subsequently. That's the most profound one. But quite recently, just before COVID, my mother, aged 92, died after a long and, you know, good life. And therefore, I felt we should celebrate the life and not be sorrowful. But life isn't like that. Even at my age, I found that death profoundly difficult to deal with. So I'm giving you, if you like, two pillars of my own experience of death, and just a further, rather minor experience, a personal one. I've had two brushes myself, two serious illnesses, and therefore I've had to face many of the events that people at the end of their lives are facing. And I know that each journey is unique. I know I can't say to somebody, I know how you feel, because I don't. But I can at least say I was on that road, and I know some of the markers on that road. You know, so that's my personal, if you like, context. And then can I just say, Liz, there's a whole sort of technical context to it as well. The work point of view, finding poems that talk to each other, that converse in a conversation with each other. Poems that are not too long. And so, in fact, you'll find a lot of extracts from poems here. Because I don't want to burden my reader. Poems that speak to this moment, and to, as I say, to people in Ireland, and that includes the new Irish as well as people who are here for a long time. One of the exciting things about the book was that Poetry Ireland commissioned a number of poems from new and young Irish poets, and that's who are either just arrived in Ireland or first generation Irish, and that's very exciting, you know.
Gorgeous. So we're a reflection of our society today.
Exactly. Yeah,
beautiful.
Yeah. But one other aspect that might be interesting when we're talking about that is that in many cases we had poems translated into or from Irish. So you get dual texts, because I was working on the principle that there are people who want to live their lives in Irish, and why shouldn't they do their dying through Irish too? And I want to respect that.
Oh, beautiful. It sounds like a book that, you know, will have immense significance to anybody Irish or living in Ireland or with a connection to Ireland, or anyone indeed who has experienced grief and loss. Because if I could say, you know, us Irish, we're pretty good with our words when it comes to poetry, and we have some amazing exports from this country. Absolutely. Mary, I want to ask you, if I can, about your mother's death. And you said, even at my age, I found that really difficult. And we make assumptions about grief in older people. I've interviewed for my training program a woman in Australia who works with people who are older. And interestingly, they did a poetry project, you know, which I can talk to you about at another stage, but they interviewed people who'd experienced profound bereavement, and then they took the interviews and cut them down and created poems out of the interviews.
Wonderful.
And then had the interviewees read the poems that had come as a result of their interviews. So really, really beautiful work from Dr. Katrin Gerber. One of the things that Katrin highlights is the assumptions we make. We assume that people who have lived a little longer are used to death, are used to grief, and don't grieve the way someone who's younger might grieve. And I'd love to dispel that myth.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Liz. It actually came as a surprise to myself, because we were prepared for it. She had been so well looked after in her final 3 weeks. She couldn't have got better care. Her family was all there. She was prepared herself for it, you know, and was able to talk about her death. She was quite articulate right up to the very late stages. And so, if you like, we had no recriminations about those aspects of her dying. And therefore, I felt this was good. It's the way it ought to be. And everybody, families and friends and neighbors came together for the funeral. And we had, you know, a beautiful funeral. And yes, you feel kind of an inexplicable loss, something that it's difficult to put the words on. And so when I found some of these poems, and I found myself thinking, yes, they're saying something. Maya Cannon, just two lines out of a poem from Maya Cannon. Let me learn from the Brent geese their grey grammar of grief. You know, let me learn the grey grammar of grief. I thought, yes, that's how I feel. And another one, Don Patterson, who's a Scottish poet. In short, he says, this is where you get off, reader. In other words, you're on your own in a way. And to have somebody say that and to recognize that makes me feel, yes, I'm glad to have those words to help me through this. I don't know whether that makes sense to you or not.
Absolutely. And, you know, you described there the friends and family and all the neighbors coming together, but nobody can step into that internal landscape.
That's right.
And grief is so physical and it's so visceral. Yeah. It's in our bodies. And somehow there is a gap between what we are experiencing and the closest person to us. You know, it's just there. Yeah. And the only thing I can liken it to, which people might identify with, is labor. And I think I've shared this before. I remember giving birth to my second son, and I was going, it had happened very quickly. I was in the bathroom in the National Maternity Hospital, not in the delivery room. And I was screaming for an epidural and screaming for a nurse. And I was like, you know, just give me everything externally that you can. And my ex-husband was there, and he was like, do you want the music? Do you want the incense? And we've gone way beyond that thing possible. But I remember sort of begging for support. And actually, one of the midwives said to me, don't be so dramatic. Well, 2 minutes later, the baby started emerging. And I tell you who looked dramatic after that. But I remember this moment of being on the delivery table with, you know, no medication, no pain relief, and realizing I am on my own. Like, stop looking outside myself here for someone who's going to give me something. This baby is coming out. I can't change my mind. There's nowhere else to go but to push this child out. But it was this feeling of the first time ever, I think, in my life where this rush of, I've got my own back. I have to, because nobody else can. Nobody else can do this. And that was a physical experience, but there's an emotional labor to grief. Yes. A very deep emotional labor. And I think we make the mistake sometimes of clawing outside ourselves. Where's the friend to show up? Where's something outside of myself that can carry this burden for me? And at a certain point, we realize, I've got to have my own back here. I've got to learn the language of the Brent geese. Exactly. I've got to do the emotional labor myself.
That's right. That's right. Oh, that sounds like a really terrible experience for you, Liz, you know, that sense of aloneness. But the other thing that strikes me, Liz, about what you said is, you know, the sheer physicality of existence, whether it's the giving birth and the starting of life or the ending of life, it starts and ends in that physical experience of pain. And as you said, that kind of existential aloneness, that nobody can bridge that gap. But a good phrase, a good few words spoken in the right tone are some kind of help. And one of the things that strikes me about poetry is, you know, just like all art can play its role in these kinds of important experiences, those life-changing experiences. But the attraction of poetry is how portable it is, how you can take it anywhere. You don't need any equipment. you know, you have, you can bar the reading of it. You can read it to a person quietly in the sick room, as well as you can read to thousands of people at a public reading. And yeah. For people who are ill and dying and the bereaved at home alone, with a gap in their lives to be filled, that's important, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you're saying there is you're addressing that gap that we spoke
yes,
about earlier.
That's
from
right.
That existential aloneness.
Profound loss can rock our inner world. It's confusing, life-altering, and often scary. You've probably already figured out that there are no stages of grief. But are there other models, theories, tools, or practices that can help us to navigate the grieving process? To learn more, visit shapesofgrief.com. As Liz says, the more people who are grief-trained, the more supportive and compassionate our society will be. And that will make life so much better for anyone coping with loss and grief. Now, let's get you back to the podcast.
Yes, I think what poetry can do is, you know, the right word or phrase, it can be as simple as that, not just an entire poem.
That's
can
right.
Let us know where this is part of our common humanity.
Yeah.
Although I am alone here, if these words have been written and they resonate with me, it means that someone else has treaded this ground. And maybe it's not my own damned life, you know?
Yes, and I feel myself part of the same human race as other people, and I take strength from that. Their experiences might be different, but we all belong to the same human race. And that's one of the things, that's one of the reasons, for example, why I included Sappho's very short poem. And we had it translated into Irish. Wait, let's see if I can find it here. It's only a couple of lines long. Sorry about this.
That's all right. You have a book behind you on your bookshelf, Charles Fawhey. I haven't seen his face for a long time.
I should have taken that down. Can we stop while I take it down?
Sure. It's kind of funny.
Sorry about that.
That's hilarious. I'd like to include that because it's kind of funny.
Well, I don't mind. A friend of mine in DCU, Gary Murphy, wrote that book, and it's a wonderful book. And that's why it's there. Yes, now I have it here. So I'll go back again there now. So Sappho, you know, is a Greek poet several thousand from, I won't give you the exact date because I don't have it in my head at the moment, but several thousand years ago. And there are only fragments of her poetry left. In the English version of her poem is translated by Katrina Nick-Larkey, and says, some say the most beautiful sight in the world is a fleet of ships, an army or horsemen, but I say it's what your heart desires. And I felt, you know, it's important for people who are dying, who are being told you have to put your affairs in order, you need to sign the deeds over to somebody of your property, you need to resolve your banking. And I'm thinking to myself, there are the affairs of the heart that need to be put in order as well. So here you have a hierarchy, and the heart's desire comes ahead of whether it is the fleet of ships you own or whatever else. That's important. And I'd love to read it for you in Irish, if I may, Liz. Is that all right?
Beautiful.
Yeah. Deridina oirehe, gurbe on riarchis oilea erdaun, no arim erwin koppel, arim erachosa nu kaulach linge. Ach, derim gurbe on rod is on saliat. So that's the idea that somebody that long ago can echo a sentiment that's relevant to my life at this moment, puts me in touch, not just with those words, but with all the experiences that put her like that. And if you wouldn't mind, there's just one other one that I think might be interesting in this point of view. A small little snippet from a long poem by a Russian poet who suffered greatly. Her poem is called Requiem, and her name is Anna Akhmatova. And an Irish poet who died some years ago, Sean Dunn, has translated this poem. It certainly isn't me. It must be someone else, for I could never bear such suffering. Take this thing and bury it. Take away the lamps and leave the night. And I mean, I think sometimes one must feel like that about pain. And I suppose what I was trying to do when I was making these selections was find poems that didn't sentimentalize the experience of dying, that had sentiment in it, but didn't cheapen that experience, that could put words on the anger and the loss and the frustration, but that didn't dwell on them in a way that somehow or other took from the strength of them. And I thought, there's a woman who suffered, and there she says it all, and yet she moved on, and yet she kept going. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of poems like that. And they're not the kind of poems, I think, that are telling you what to do in an authoritative way, but rather saying, this is how I coped.
Yeah, it's giving language to that internal landscape. Exactly. Mary, you said you had a brush with serious illness also. Did that help you select poems for this collection?
I think it did, because, you know, when you're facing major surgery and you have been diagnosed with cancer for the second time, you don't know what that road ahead is going to be, and you have to start preparing yourself for the next step. Now, I've been very lucky, and I understand my experiences are not like those of the people that we're here. So I do want to distinguish between them. But I do think it gave me some sort of intimations of mortality rather than of immortality, shall we say. And therefore, yes, they were in my mind. And my own, the whole gamut of emotions that I had also, I think, informed how I went about looking at these poems. I think that is the case. And finding the words. And then I found myself thinking of other people who found themselves dying in more difficult circumstances, shall we say. And there's one poem that I've included in the selection by Patrick Deely, and it's called A Man from Derry Bryan. And he's a horse of a man, the man he's talking about. You know, a man who worked in the buildings in England. A man that you could imagine who was on his own at the end of his life, a broken horse in Camden Town, forgotten as a matter of course. And I thought, we can't remember, we can't forget the forgotten. So although it did help me, I think, to make an initial selection, I was very conscious of the fact that there are far more difficult situations being faced by people. And I am very humble in the face of that. And I do hope that that there's nothing here that would offend anyone.
I'm sure not. I'm sure you've thought of everything. But, you know, something that people don't really realize, I think, Mary, is to get a difficult diagnosis that's potentially terminal, but maybe we don't know yet, it does give us a brush with death. We don't know what the future holds. And I think, you know, people often go into survival mode and get their treatments or their surgeries. And from my experience as a therapist, it's 6 months after the all clear or 12 months after the all clear where I get the knock at the door, and it's from people going, what the hell just happened? You know, but it's, everyone else is like, oh, isn't it great? Your cancer's gone, or it was successful, or you fought that, you know, all that awful battle language. But actually, existentially, or, you know, internally, it can be such a shakeup. Even though the outcome is wonderful, we still have had that brush with the unknown, that brush right. with our mortality. We've still lost that innocence. That's you know, right. we all have this, we know we're going to die someday, but we know it with some tiny little part of our, you know, cortex. Yeah. I think when we receive a diagnosis, we begin to know it more fully with our bodies and ourselves and our hearts. And that can be scary. Would you speak to that a little, Mary?
Yes, I suppose I wasn't prepared for talking about myself here this morning. So I have difficulty finding the words to express how I feel about all of that. I absolutely agree with everything you've said. And as a therapist, you know more about this than I do, but I identify very strongly about with what you said about having to find a whole new perspective and a whole new vocabulary in order to re-encounter the life with fresh eyes that I had previously lived. And there's another factor, I suppose, when you're at my age. I am now, it's only 4 years since my mother died, but I'm now moving into the kind of territory where people my age that I was close to, that I identify with in groups and so on, are now facing their final journey. And this comes as a terrible shock, even though we know it's inevitable. We know at a cerebral level, but emotionally it still comes, I think, as a bit of a, not a bit of a shock, quite an emotional battering. I often think back, you know, to the day, for example, that Seamus Heaney died, 2013. He was relatively young. I think he was about 73. Many of us felt that Seamus Heaney could be relied upon to be wise and to identify with a lot of the experiences of Irish people and to shape it into the kind of language that would last. And I had this terrible sense of loss, not just for me personally, but for everybody in Ireland, that there was this man who understood what it was to a person who walked anywhere in Ireland. You know, who was so generous with his time in trying to make sense of Irish experiences. And that was taken from us, you know.
Yeah. It's a lovely reflection. And the pleasure of meeting Seamus Heaney. I think his wife was a teacher.
That's right.
She was looking after our class when I was in sixth class. I was a 12-year-old, and my teacher was on maternity leave. And he was brought in to us one day and recited some poetry. And we certainly didn't appreciate him as 12-year-olds the way we did once we hit the adult world and understood the landscape that he was describing so beautifully in his poetry. So Mary, maybe just changing gear a little, will you tell me about this book and how it's structured? Because it has very distinct sections, doesn't it?
Well, it's broadly in two sections, but they're not self-enclosed sections. One addresses the person who's at the end of life, and the other then addresses the carers and the bereaved, you know, the friends and the family and the broader community of the person who has died. But when I was doing it, I was conscious to myself that the person who is at the end of life will want to look at that second section also, because they too have been bereaved. And as they face this next step in their journey, they'll want to think about people that they knew and their experience and their own experience of bereavement. So I don't see these as too self-locked sections. They engage with each other. That's my first principle. The second principle, as I said to you already, was that I wanted to talk primarily to people in Ireland, and primarily the people who are dying. So therefore, I thought to myself, one's concentration may not be long. I didn't want to set a schoolroom tone to what I was doing. I'm not trying to teach anybody anything. I feel myself very humble in the company of people who have this profound experience and this lonely profound experience. And I can only go so far. So I'm aware of all that. I wasn't going to teach anybody anything. And therefore, I omitted many of the poems that people might have expected to find, you know, for example, like Tennyson or a great deal of Shakespeare on death. And indeed, I would have loved to have a bit more of Seamus Heaney in there. But for now, this is as much as we can have. I wanted to get a broad kind of church together. I wanted poems that would appeal to people who are not literary, people who are not interested in reading poetry per se, you know. I wanted to say to people, this is for everybody. This is something about your own experience. Just a little haiku from a man called Dennis O'Driscoll, who was a great friend of poetry. He was a civil servant, he was a lawyer, but he was also Seamus Heaney's executor, a literary executor when he died. But here he is talking about the cemetery, the blackness of the cemetery blackbird, its song an octave lower. Isn't that wonderful? And no, you know, even if you're never interested in poetry, I think you might say, yeah, I know what he's talking about. I know where he's coming from. So then I wanted to have honest emotion in there. As I said, I didn't want it sentimentalized or manipulated in any way, and I hope that we have succeeded there. I wanted then to think about the various experiences of death and dying. So there are some key poems and key experiences. We talked about the death of my mother. So you have Paul Muldoon talking about Ma, his mother. I could have taken any number of poems by Muldoon, but I chose this one in part because he calls her Ma, you know. There's Patrick Kavanagh on his mother. I put in two by Patrick Kavanagh. One also about his father. Every old man I see reminds me of my father. And I think we all have that experience, don't we?
Would you read one of those poems?
Yes. Well, why don't I read Kavanagh? Because people will perhaps know this one. Memory of My Father, it's called. Every old man I see reminds me of my father when he had fallen in love with death one time when sheaves were gathered. The man I saw in Gardner Street stumble in the curb was one. He stared at me half-eyed. I might have been his son. And I remember the musician faltering over his fiddle in Bayswater, London. He too set me the riddle. Every old man I see in October-coloured weather seems to say to me, I was once your father. And then, you know, that's followed by one by Tom French, Night Drive, where he says, the closest mother we've been in years was a night drive back from Achill and our own. You know, that moment of intimacy is captured. And we have it again in one of the Seamus Heaney poems I collected. It was one of the most famous, or the poems most loved in Ireland, where he's folding the clothes, the peeling the potatoes. Yes, exactly. So those moments of intimacy are important. I also have poems about the death of children. And there are love poems in there as well that record the death of the spouse, the loved one. You know, some going back to the 16th century in Ireland, and you say to yourself, yes, this is how it was. Nothing has changed really in that sense of loss, that terrible sense where you're stopped in your tracks by that big gap that's left in your life. There's a lovely poem there by Paddy Bush about the death of a child, Marvna Oisin, and I have it in Irish and in English, translated by Paddy Bush himself. There's one that captured the imagination of a lot of people during the COVID experience. My sister is not a statistic. Do you remember that being read on the radio one morning?
Yeah, and I thought maybe you'd read it.
I'll read at least some of it. It's Dorothy Duffy as the writer, and it's called My Sister Is Not a Statistic. And so this is what Dorothy says. Tomorrow, when the latest deathometer of COVID is announced in sonorous tones, when all the bodies still mount and curl towards the middle of the curve, heat one atop and alongside the other, my sister will be among those numbers, among the throwaway lines, among the platitudes and lower dies, an older person with underlying health conditions. A pitiful way to lay rest the bare bones of a life. My sister is not a statistic. Her underlying conditions were love, kindness, belief in the essential goodness of mankind, uproarious laughter, forgiveness, compassion, a storyteller, a survivor, a comforter, a force of nature, and so much more. My sister is not a statistic. She died without the soft touch of a loved one's hand, without the feathered kiss upon her forehead, without the muted murmur of a familiar family voices gathered around her bed, without the gentle roar of laughter that comes with memories recalled, evoked from a time that already seemed distanced, when we were connected by the simplicity of touch, of voice, of presence. My sister is not a statistic. She was a woman who spanned the seven ages, a mother, a grandmother, a great-grandmother, a sister, a friend, an aunt, a carer, a giver. My sister is not a statistic. And so she joins the mounting thousands. They are not statistics on the deathometer of COVID. They are the wives, mothers, children, fathers, sisters, brothers, the layers of all our loved ones. If she could believe me when I say, she would hold every last one of your loved ones, croon to and comfort them and say, you were loved. Whilst we who have been left behind mourn deep, keening the loss, the injustice, the rage. One day we will smile and laugh again. We will remember with joy that once we shared a life. We knew joy and survived sadness. You are my sister and I love you. So I think that was such a powerful antidote to the culture of the statistics.
Absolutely. It's such a moving piece, you know, brings me right back to hearing it, you know, for the first time. And, you know, it's extraordinary because now, you know, in the aftermath of COVID, although it's still around, but in the aftermath of the restrictions and those nightly bulletins, there's so many people saying, what was that all about? And that was handled so badly. And so how quickly we've forgotten the bereaved, how quickly we've forgotten those people who had to say goodbye over an iPad if they were lucky enough, or had to watch hours on end of mass graves on the TV.
That's right.
It must never be forgotten, actually.
That's right. Yes, that's right. And it's worth having that there for no other reason than that, I think. Just the idea that we must remember, we must not forget the forgotten, as I said earlier. We mustn't forget the forgotten. I think. And then you asked me about how the book was constructed. I could have included a lot of public poems, but I didn't. I thought long and hard about it. And there's only one poem in a way that spans the idea of a public poem, apart from this one, My Sister Is Not a Statistic. And it's a poem by the poet Eleni Quillenoan about the Morandi Bridge. You remember about the bridge that collapsed in Italy. And Elaine was driving in Italy at the time. And Elaine has recently suffered a bereavement. Her partner and husband had died. So there's a sense of the combined grief of the public and the private in this poem that I think she captured very well. And that's why that poem is in there. And then the final poem in the book is consciously entitled Begin. We're at the end, and I'm hoping that people will begin. And it's a poem by Brendan Kennelly, a wonderful, wonderfully eloquent talker, lecturer, poet, a man of great strong emotions. And he talks, and a man who suffered himself a great deal, and he knows what he's talking about when he exhorts us to begin again. And so that's why that poem is at the end.
Would you read it, please, Mary?
I will, of course. So, Begin by Brendan Kennelly. Begin again to the summoning birds, to the sight of the light at the window. Begin to the roar of the morning traffic all along Pembroke Road. Every beginning is a promise, born in light and dying in dark determination and exaltation of springtime flowering the way to work. Begin to the pageant of queuing girls, the arrogant loneliness of swans in the canal, bridges linking the past and future, old friends passing through with a still. Begin to the loneliness that cannot end, since it perhaps is what makes us begin. Begin to wonder at unknown faces, at crying birds in the sudden rain, at branches stark in the willing sunlight. And so the last word is sunlight. I think there's something terribly moving about the arrogant loneliness of the swans in the canal, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah. Someone who understood the human condition. And actually, I interviewed his niece two or three episodes ago, who spoke about, who just spoke about the grief of dementia, losing someone to dementia, as Brendan Kennelly had.
Yes.
But yeah, there's hope in that. And I think, you know, when someone very close to us dies, life is a new beginning. It never goes back to the way it was, you know, and we are childlike in our vulnerability often. And it is a new beginning. It's like, how do I walk this path now without them at home or by my side? You know, every death does bring a new beginning.
It must bring a new beginning. And I would hope that one of the things the book might do is dispel some fear, you know, by putting names on things, by talking in a meaningful way, in a way that I can't talk about loneliness, the arrogant loneliness of swans and so on, by putting words on those emotions, that we'll dispel the fear and the anxiety that goes with the unknown. We can say, I am part of this human race. I can move towards some kind of serenity because, you know, I can say something about the future. I know something about the future. I can begin again. It's a big ask of people, I suppose, but I hope that there will be some help there for them.
I've no doubt, Mary, you know, and I think, in I live in Greystones, a small village, and, you know, when an untimely death happens or a tragedy happens, it's the sense of aloneness of, why did this happen? Our family, this isn't usual. This is not what other families go through. And we can feel so terribly alone and ask, why me? Why my child? Why my family? And then we find a collection like this and we go, well, it isn't just me. And it isn't just my child. And it isn't just my family. Parents have been bereaved for centuries. Partners have lost their lovers for centuries. As long as there's been love, there's been loss. And, you know, it's something we know, like we've both said, cerebrally for a long time. But it's only when you read it, you realize the magnitude of that reality. This is common humanity throughout the ages. And actually, I'm just a little dot on the whole big spectrum of loss and love. Yeah,
exactly. There are two other points I'd like to read, if Liz, if you're happy about that. The two other aspects of the book. One has to do with the fact that I wanted to put in a little bit of levity into it as well. Finding the right kind of humour can be very difficult in this sort of situation. But I have two poems that I think are absolutely wonderful on that front myself. And then I wanted to remember the carers. And there's a poem in there by Seamus Heaney called Miracle. And if you remember in St. John's Gospel, there's the story about a man who was paralysed, and there's a miracle, and he's told, take up your bed and walk, and he does. So he's been carried in on a stretcher and he walked out. And what Heaney is talking about is, what about the people that nobody mentions in this story who carried that stretcher? And the ropes over their shoulders, and the way the ropes dug into them, and the weight that was emotional and physical of carrying those people. These are the people that need to be remembered. So that poem, Miracle, is very important because it remembers the workers in the hospice, the families at home who do all the caring and providing and, you know, do the jobs that nobody talks about. And I felt that was very important. And maybe I'll begin with the one by John O'Leary, who was a Canadian poet who died in an accident, a boating accident in West Cork. And here he is preparing his to-do list, you know, the kind of list we all do at the beginning of the day about the work we have to do. So this is John O'Leary's to-do list. 1, find dragon and slay. 2, exorcise cat. 3, prove conclusively the identity of beauty and truth. 4, watch, fast and pray. 5, sail Atlantic single-handed. 6, write name in water. 7, return, teach yourself waltzing tape. 8, weep for Adonis and feel bad. 9, write her a letter telling her you love her. 10, go out into the midnight and check new stars. Isn't that lovely? Absolutely. You know, it kind of captures, you know, the way we sometimes waste our time on less important things. And maybe these are the important things: exorcising the cat, finding the dragon and slaying it. This matters too in life, doesn't it? And there's a lovely one by Kieran Carson, a wonderful poet from Northern Ireland, who talks about what he fears. And, you know, it's both funny and sad and anxious at the same time. And I think that captures the way I feel. Can I read that for you, Liz?
Please do, yeah.
Okay, it's called Fear by Kieran Carson. I fear the vast dimensions of eternity. I fear the gap between the platform and the train. I fear the onset of a murderous campaign. I fear the palpitations caused by too much tea. I fear the drawn pistol of a rapparee. I feel the books will not survive the acid rain. I feel the ruler and the blackboard and the cane. I fear the jabberwock, whatever it might be. I fear the bad decisions of a referee. I fear the only recourse is to plead insane. I fear the implications of a lawyer's fee. I fear the gremlins that have colonized my brain. I fear to read the small print of a guarantee. And what else do I fear? Let me begin again. So I think that's sort of funny. And yes, that's how I feel much of the time myself. I identify with it. And it gives you a sense of proportion, doesn't it? There's not much point in me fearing the drawn pistol of the rapparee at this stage of my life. But nonetheless, it's something that comes up. So those are put in there, I suppose, for just to say, yes, we can crack jokes if they're the right ones. People don't lose their sense of humor because they're closing the door as they go out.
And I think, you know, with every emotion is valid in grief, you know. That's grief is right. Like an umbrella that encompasses a variety of different emotions. Yeah. It's not just sadness, it's rage, it's anger, it's terror, it's anxiety, it's humor, you know, and to give permission, you know, you're allowed to laugh. It won't last. You'll be in floods of tears in a minute, but won't last either, you know.
Yeah.
And to make space for all of that and normalize it is vital.
So maybe I could read the Seamus Heaney poem called Miracle as well, because I do want to honour the carers. And this poem, as I say, is important in doing that work.
I'm delighted you came back to it.
Oh, good, good. And just as I said earlier, it's based on an episode in St. John's Gospel where a miracle happens and a man who'd been stretchered into a room is able to take up his bed and walk out. And John says nothing about the carers, the people who stretchered him in and who carried his weight metaphorically as well as physically into the room. So Miracle by Seamus Heaney. Not the one who takes up his bed and walks, but the ones who have known him all along and carry him in. Their shoulders numb, the ache and stoop deep locked in their backs, the stretcher handles slippery with sweat. And no let up until he's strapped on tight, made tiltable and raised to the tiled floor, then lowered for healing. Be mindful of them as they stand and wait for the burn of the paid out rope to cool, their slight lightheadedness and incredulity to pass, those ones who have known him all along. So this is our tribute to those who have known the ill person all along.
And it's lovely. I'm particularly mindful, Mary, of Palliative Care Week coming up in Ireland in September.
And, yes.
You know, just the caring that goes on for people inside office doors and indeed inside homes is extraordinary, is absolutely extraordinary. And there's a love and compassion there that you don't find anywhere else. A certain love and compassion that's present.
And I have reason to know that at the moment because a member of my family is in palliative care as I speak. And the quality of care he's getting in Milford House in Limerick is just second to none. And we're eternally grateful for the calmness and the serenity and the thoughtfulness and empathy of the staff of Milford House.
That's a lovely tribute. It goes a long way in easing the experience of grief to know that the people we love have been so deeply cared for and loved by others as well as ourselves. It's something that myself and Mary Kennelly speak about in our interview a couple of episodes ago. Yes. So Mary, who is this book for?
The book is... in a way, those are two different questions. The book, I want to talk primarily to the person who's on that final journey, moving on. And I want to be able to say, this might give you some equivalent of what the hospice carers give and what therapists like you give. It's a different mode of communicating it, and I hope it'll be some kind of support. So primarily, I want to talk to the person who's at the end of their lives. I also want to talk to people who are grieving and who are pained with grief and don't know how to express that pain. But I'm also hoping that perhaps people like therapists might find this book useful in their work and might be able to find snatches of words there that might start a conversation off in therapy. I asked myself whether it would be useful for people who are running rituals and ceremonies for people who are dying, whether they're church ceremonies or not. This is not a religious book per se, but it is in no way, it will be very comfortable, I think, in religious settings because it acknowledges the dignity and respect and the vast eternity that is beyond us. So I'm hoping that people who are conducting religious and civic ceremonies of dying may find it useful also. And I think it might find a place in schools and perhaps aspects of universities as well, and certainly in libraries where people can call on it at moments when they might need it.
And anybody who has a history of contemplation, we are all going to be at end of life, you know.
That's right. And,
you know, no harm to read it now. Don't wait till we're skidding through the doors at the end. Where was that book? Yeah. Read it now. Like it can go a long way in preparing us all a little bit for the finite nature of life. And tomorrow is not guaranteed for any of us.
That's right. You've said it perfectly, Liz. That's exactly right. So it is a book for everyone, really. I'd love to think it's the kind of book that one could give to somebody who's encountering a difficult time and say, you might find some consolation here.
Yeah.
And I was just going to say that I suppose one should say a word about the publishers, who've been wonderful in this. When I pitched this idea first to Gill Publishing, it was to Deirdre Nolan, who was their editor at the time, and she immediately saw the value of it. And then I worked, so the editor I worked with, Rachel, has been so wonderful as well to work with, and the whole team that they have behind them have worked with the Hospice Foundation in getting this book this far, and we look forward to having it published, I understand, in September. So I'd like to thank all those people as well.
Wonderful. And anyone particularly in the Irish Hospice Foundation?
Well, there's a number of people in the Hospice Foundation and in Poetry Ireland that I'd like to recognise. Rebecca Lloyd was the person who came up with the idea with Jane O'Hanlon from Poetry Ireland in the first instance. But then the Rebecca Kelly in their communications section in the Irish Hospice Foundation, Lynn Murta also was a very important person in getting this moving. And then Dominic Campbell became the education officer the arts officer, I should say, not the education officer, in the Hospice Foundation after the work began. And he did Trojan work in promoting this. And then the chair of the Irish Hospice Foundation, Jean Callanan, also put her shoulder behind the wheel. She was just wonderful in that she recognised the importance of that. And then there was a whole team in Poetry Ireland who promoted this book as well. Niamh O'Donnell, I mentioned earlier, who was then the director of Poetry Ireland and has moved on. Catherine Ann Cullen, who is the poet in residence, and you'll find one of her poems in this selection as well. She worked so hard to support us when we were doing this. And Elizabeth Moen was also one of the team from Poetry Ireland, who was excellent. Liz Kelly is now the Poetry Ireland director, and she will be behind this when the book is out as well. And Poetry Ireland is temporarily in accommodation in Dublin City University. They have offices there while their own offices are being renovated. And so Dublin City University is going to promote this and help in numerous ways as well. And especially Orla Nicky in the library and the president of DCU, Professor Dara Kill, both of those have been really, really helpful in promoting this.
It was fantastic. So it's been a real community effort.
It has. A mehel.
Yeah, a mehel. When I was coming onto our Zoom call this morning, I remembered back to my own father's death in 2020, in March 2020, during one of the lockdowns. And it's interesting because, you know, I wasn't seeing many friends at the time. I moved in with him to care for him alongside other family members. And I remember as he was dying, I asked on Facebook, you know, my friends were like, how's it going? And it was my one little connection to the outside world. And I remember, I don't remember if he was dying or if it was the moment of his death. I asked people to send me poems.
Did you read?
I said, hey, send me your poetry. Yeah. Send me the prose and poetry that, you know, that will reflect what I'm going through here. And it was so interesting. Like, some of them were just a salve to the heart immediately. Yes. And then others were just grating, you know, grating on my ears.
Yes.
But it sounds like the collection that you've put together here are going to be a salve to the brokenhearted and a balm to anyone who's going through suffering. So well done, Mary, and thank you as well.
Well, it was done with all those other people. They all were behind it as well. I'm really sorry to hear about your father's death, particularly during COVID, Liz. That must have been very, very difficult.
It's funny. I don't know if it's my profession or what, but for me, certainly, because it was during COVID, everything was put into perspective. Yes. And actually, gratitude was the predominant feeling I had, because we kept him at home.
That was wonderful, yeah.
He didn't have COVID. His death was peaceful. Good. There was no suffering.
Good.
You know, so
yes.
Against the landscape of COVID, I realized how absolutely lucky and blessed we were, you know. And I miss him. It's funny, it's year two now, and I find myself tearing up much more easily than I did last year.
Yes.
Last year, there was a little bit of relief and gratitude, yes. Like I say. This year, it's more than the permanence of, oh God, and he's not coming back, you know. But I did drop into his house yesterday. He lived in Blackrock, and the house is for sale. And I was meeting a friend for dinner. but beforehand I dropped into the house. I haven't been there for a while. And there's his plum tree laden down with the most perfect plums. And it was like, you know, he's been dead 18 months, but here his life is still giving. And I went into the kitchen, got a big old greasy oven dish and filled it with the most perfect, beautiful purple plums.
Wonderful.
And I think those ways of continuing connection are all around when we're open to look for them. So.
Yeah. And like Kavanagh said, every old man I see reminds me of my father.
Huh? Oh, I know. Sure, I'm sure if anyone's looking at this on YouTube, you'll see my glasses have been steamed up since
I'm
the beginning of our talk today.
I find myself like that too. And just to add to what you were saying about your father dying, one of my own experiences, my mother died in the Bonsecours Hospital in Tralee, and they were wonderful. This was in 2018. And at one stage in her very last days, we brought in a relative. We sang to her, but we brought in a Shannon singer, and he sang some of the songs she loved and the poems. We said the poems, and people collected outside the door of her room on the corridor, you know, the people who worked in the hospital to hear this. And there was such a sense of community, of all of us coming together. And even though my mother, the reaction was minimal, but there was a reaction, and it was a pleasurable reaction. You felt that somehow or other, that the poetry and the song was a way of celebrating the life. And this is what I'm trying to do in my own small way. I'm no poet, and I know it, but I think I can recognize a good poem when I see it. And that's my contribution to other people.
That just sounds so beautiful with the Shannon singers. And it's like standing on the shoulders of everyone who's ever
that's
accompanied
them
before us for decades. It's like, it's that tradition, the container of the tradition, and all our ancestors, everyone who's gone before us, and now it's our turn, you know. Yes. And it takes away the loneliness of death.
That's
and the
it.
Isolation of grief. You know, if anything, it's you're not alone. People have done this for centuries, you know, and come together, like the Irish Hospice Foundation say this over and over again, the importance of friends, family, community. And it's never too late, you know. I'm still mulling over the idea of having a celebration for Dad, because only 14 of us were at his funeral.
Yes.
And I miss that. It's a deficit I have of hearing the stories from people about him. And it's something I think I will do, maybe for his second anniversary, bring people together who weren't gathered when he died. It feels important.
We do need the ritual in our lives. We do need to mark these occasions in some kind of formal way that's fitting to it. And I love the image of the plum tree. That plum tree will always fill that gap of absence that there is in your life. I think the image of the plum tree is there like a perpetual star in your life, isn't it?
It's
a bit out of a poem by Brian Lynch that's there, never to be really met again, although remaining always in sight like the perpetual star in the evening. That sort of captures that, I think, doesn't it?
It's so funny.
And presence.
Yeah, it's so true. And for me, he's all over his garden, you know, that's where I find him. But
indeed.
What was really funny was, you know, we sold his house and got, you know, a good price for his house. And just last week, the sale fell through. And rather than, you know, affairs of the head, the business and all of that, my immediate response internally was, yay, another season of plums and apples.
Oh, good. Exactly.
You know, and with some of his neighbors chatting on the street, and they were asking what's happening in the house. And together we were all going, oh, maybe we'll get another autumn out of it. Because Dad used to always come out to the neighbors with plums and apples and all the fruits of his garden.
Beautiful.
So us, this was what we wanted. You know, forget the million for the house. We were delighted with another season of plums and apples and a little bit of him for a little bit longer.
Yeah, and I suppose these poems are a bit like the plums and the apples. You know, they're within the covers of the book and they'll always be there. There will always be a season for them, for people who are ill.
Well, I know Percy, I cannot wait genuinely to get my hands on a hard copy. I've been lucky to have a digital copy in advance. It's not the final version, but I cannot wait to own this. And I know I will be gifting it to many, many people this Christmas. And I hope I get to meet you, Mary, and get a signed copy.
I'm sure we'll have a launch, Liz. I'm sure there will be a launch. And if there is, I look forward to meeting you. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. And I must say too that it's not my habit to talk about myself in the way I have done with you today. It's the first time I've ever done this. So that is testimony to your empathy, I think, and your ability to engage with people. And so I want to thank you for that and, you know, for leading me through the book in a meaningful way. It's like you were showing me the signposts on the way.
Thank you so much. And, you know, I think we do a disservice to people if we only show up with our heads, especially when we're talking about grief. You know, we have to bring our entire human selves or it doesn't mean anything, really, you know.
Absolutely.
We cannot talk from the brain about grief. It just wouldn't resonate with anyone. So thank you for being willing to come with your own humanity, Mary, and your own experience of loss.
And thank you too. And if I could leave you with just a few words from somebody greater than I, Derek Mahan, Against the Clock. He wrote this poem when he knew he was dying. He was in the last stages. And he's a writer, so he's talking about writing. Writing against the clock, the flying calendar. Don't give up or give in. We're obliged to stick it out until the poem falls from the trembling hand. So just get on with it. So that's what I'm trying to do. We're obliged to keep going, so let's keep going. And thank you so much, Liz, for a wonderful conversation, from my point of view, at least.
Yeah, absolutely gorgeous. Mary, lovely to meet you. Best of luck with the book, and I know our paths will cross.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye now.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Shapes of Grief. This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical or psychological advice. And if your grief is making you unwell, please do see your healthcare provider. Once again, please consider supporting the podcast by donating on shapesofgrief.com or becoming a patron on patreon.com. I rely on your support to keep going. The music is performed by Baka Beyond, especially for the Shapes of Grief podcast. Until the next time, from me, Liz Gleeson, take really good care. She has come down to condemn the wild ocean.
absolutely gorgeous.